This is part one in a two-part series. This series discusses drug use, violence, and crime scenes. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. There are things Sonia Perez knows about her mother, Lily Aline Squeque Finley. Most everyone called her Cherokee. Those who didn't called her daughter, sister, mama, auntie, or meemaw. Sonia knows her mother was a giving person, someone who would open her doors to anyone who needed help, wherever they lived. Whether it was on the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Flathead Reservation in Montana, or on the Puyallup Reservation in Washington, or anywhere in between. Sonia remembers moving back and forth between both reservations, with her mother, her stepfather, who she called Dad, her siblings, and she was used to Cherokee taking in others along the way who needed help. A warm jacket, a sandwich, a place to sleep. She'd offer it. That was one of the many great qualities that Sonia saw in her mother. Sonia also knows that her mother was married to her birth father when she was born. The relationship hadn't worked out, and Sonia had spent a few years with her paternal grandparents while Cherokee established herself. She knows that Cherokee had wanted to know more about her own native heritage, but that Cherokee's own mother, Sonia's grandmother, didn't want her children to carry that knowledge. It's only recently, through an older relative's documentation, that she's learned more about her mother's specific tribal associations. Those records led Sonia to the Natchitoches tribe of Louisiana, which is Cherokee's home state. Sonia knows her mother was a passionate, loving woman. She knows her mother struggled with drugs and alcohol on and off throughout her life. But, Sonia points out, she never let her children go without. She knows that Cherokee loved her grandchildren and her friends and family immensely. And then there are the things that Sonia doesn't know. The things she's had to try and unravel herself, bit by bit, in the years since Cherokee's untimely death. Because when her mother's body was discovered in an isolated wooded area of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Flathead Reservation in late April of 1998, Sonia felt that she knew something else. That her mother, Cherokee Finley, had been murdered. There were multiple agencies involved in the case. This was because Cherokee had been discovered on the reservation. Sonia tells us they included the Lake County Sheriff, the FBI, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the reservation's tribal police. The Montana Department of Justice was also consulted. The paperwork shared with us included some documentation from the Lake County Sheriff in cooperation with that department. The official autopsy report did not list homicide as the cause of death. Sonia knew that too. She'd watched it all unfold, and then she requested that same paperwork to read for herself. It took her a while to get it, but she did, and then she read the coroner's report and the notes from her own mother's autopsy exam. It was laid out quite simply in the Montana Department of Justice's forensic report. The report was requested by the Lake County coroner, and these were a few of the facts. Date last known alive, 4/10/98. Date found, 4/29/98. Cause of death, hypothermia. Manner of death, accident. As far as the Montana Department of Justice was concerned, the case was closed in a few weeks. But Sonia doesn't think her mother's death can be explained away so simply. She has questions about the crime scene and evidence collected and not tested and word of evidence that wasn't collected at all. She wants to know about her mother's injuries, the ones recorded on the official report and the ones shown in photos of the scene. She also wants to know what happened to her mother's car, because Sonia tells us it was never recovered. And according to Sonia, there were rumors that some people in town had even bragged about events that tied into her mother's death. Sonia told us that not long after her mother's death, she arrived in Montana. While she was there, she heard a nightly news headline about Cherokee that went something like this. Another Native woman found in the woods. For 24 years, that description has stuck with Sonia. Cherokee Finley's death didn't create many waves with the local media, and her case is closed, so the investigation can't go any further. Not unless one of the involved agencies decides to take another look, with cause to consider homicide. That's what Sonia has hoped for, as she's worked to piece together what she knows and what she doesn't. More answers and more questions come every year. When Cherokee died, she was 46 years old, close to 47, and had seen the first few of her grandchildren born. Now, those grandchildren are grown. Sonia wishes that she knew more about the days leading up to her mother's death. At the time, Sonia and Cherokee were living in separate states, and they'd also experienced a break in their communication. But Sonia has done everything in her power since to discover everything she can about the day her mother disappeared and the day she was found and what happened in between. She wants to know why rumors of murder have continued for so long when Cherokee's death was ruled as accidental. We spoke with Sonia in early 2022 after a mutual friend connected us. Like many other stories, her family's is a complex one. And like any family story, it deserves attention. Sonia began the interview by telling us about her mother, Cherokee's life as a young woman. You'll hear Sonia mention her biological father in the next section, and Sonia asked us to clarify that her biological father questioned her older brother's paternity because of his looks and not due to any other suspicion.
My grandmother, her mother had five children. My mother kind of went and did her own thing. She met my father. She married my biological father in California. Both me and my brothers were born in California.
Do you know how they met?
My mother was living in California at the time when she met my father. And I would say she was in her teen years, between 13 and 15. They married at a very young age. I actually have their wedding pictures that were sent to me after her mom passed away recently. So she married my father in California. They obviously had something about my brother having blonde hair and blue eyes, so he couldn't be a Mexican. And then she didn't know she was pregnant with me. She left my father. I guess they fought a lot about that, about my brother not being him, because my brother looked more like her father, who was of Caucasian descent. My grandmother was Native, but back then she never was proud to state that she was Native American, because back in her day they were savages. You were either a savage or not a savage. And so she chose not to be a savage. My mother left home. In California, she met my father. When I was born, my mother left me in the hospital after she gave birth to me. And I went home to my biological father's family until I reunited with my mother for the first time when I was like very young.
Do you remember how old she was when you would have been born?
My mother was 18 or 19 or 20, because she was 18, 19 when she had my brother. In California, she met my father. I call him my dad because he was the one that he's the only dad, only father I've ever known when I was growing up. Her and dad got married in Washington, and we moved back and forth. She was very young. I want to say she was 19, 20 when she got with dad.
Once Cherokee married Sonia's stepfather, who we'll call her dad from this point on, and got established, Sonia and her older brother were living with them. Then Sonia's younger siblings came along, and there were soon 7 kids in total. Sonia's dad, who was enrolled in the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes of the Flathead Nation for most of his life, had family living on both the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Flathead Reservation in Montana and on the Puyallup Reservation in Washington. He moved his family between both locations.
We lived on welfare. 7 kids, gave her enough food stamps and money for the month. She had was able to cover everything at that time. We got commodities from the tribe, whether it was here in Puyallup or back in Montana. We would get the commodities from the tribal agencies. I know that she always kept a roof over our head, so she was always ahead of the game. And she had another place before we had to be out of a place. We never were on the streets. We never had to live with people. She always provided a house, and then she always invited everybody she knew into that house. If they needed a warm place to go or a good food to eat or just somewhere to chill out. I know she took in 3 teenage runaways here in Tacoma one time. I still keep in touch with those ladies. And they didn't want to live at their house, so my mother put them up and they lived with us. And she always cooked. Dad always hunted. I remember being in Montana and Dad would go get the deer or the elk and hang it in the shed. Me and my mom would go skin it and cut it. And then we would grind our own meat. We didn't really have any fancy meals, but she always had a meal. She could make anything out of nothing. Very creative. You know, sometimes it was simple, hot dogs, macaroni and cheese, and it would have chip sandwiches. When we went on road trips, she'd buy a loaf of bread and some lunch meat and cheese. And that's what we would have to eat in the car. But she always provided food, no matter what. We never went without nourishment. We never went without shelter. We never went without having a warm place to sleep and be at any given time. So I really praise my mom on that. She was a strong-willed woman. I got that. She cared and she was compassionate about people. I definitely got that. Didn't care who or what walk of life he came from. She always had open arms. And I have open arms, you know. It's just all of the good things about her have been inbred in me. And I think that I love doing what I do because it reminds me of her compassion for others. That's what I gained from my mother.
Sonia told us that her father was the one who began calling her mother Cherokee, not Lily. Soon, that's what everyone knew her as, who wasn't her child.
My dad gave us all names. But I was Bones. My older brother was Playboy because all he wanted to do was play video games and play outside and not do any man work. My sister Birdie is Roxanne. My sister Darlene is Cheyenne. My sister Beverly that passed away was Clan Woman because she cried a lot. And my sister Karen is Girl. My little brother Benny is Little Man. And those were all names that were given by my dad. Got called by your name, you come with caution. And sometimes it was so funny. My mom would get so mad and she'd call you everybody but the name before she got to your name. Birdie, I mean Darlene, Deborah, I mean Karen, I mean Sonia. She'd go through all with it. And then we all got baptized on the same day. My godmother is a sister's assistant with the Catholic Church in Montana at the time. And we leave in the church, and my mom's out in the church parking lot. You little heathens, get in the car. The godmother walks up to her and says, Cherokee, you can't call them heathens anymore. Every one of them's been baptized now. We kept it humorous, I guess. not a lot of responsibility was taught, but we did, I mean, we lived the best life that we could. My mother later went to school at Flathead College in Montana for some nursing and stuff, and she took care of elderly people and things like that when she was sober and clean, because she would go long periods of time and keep it together. But it wasn't until we were all adults that my deaf mother worked.
But her work was having seven kids.
That was true. Having seven kids, I don't even know how I would handle that.
Even having one kid is a lot of work. And to be able to provide for them with very little resources, it sounds like she was really creative and resourceful.
And that's exactly where I get it from, because to this day, I still help my kids and I still make it stretch and I make sure that I got enough to help. She did that. And those are the qualities that I got from her. And that's what I'm so thankful for. She was very much into the Native American craft. She did do some beading. She actually, to this day, in my car right now, I have, when she lived with me in Oregon and she was clean and sober for that brief moment, she made me a pair of moccasins to hang from my car. And on the bottoms of the moccasins, it says, "To my girl, love, Mom." Because that's what she called me. She didn't call me her daughter. She didn't call me Sonia. She always called my girl, my girl.
You were her first girl.
I was the first girl. The older I get, the more I look like her. I'm very outspoken like her. Like I said, I have all of her great qualities.
As the second oldest child and the oldest girl, Sonia felt a lot of responsibility for her younger siblings. And because there was intermittent drug and alcohol abuse in their home while they grew up, she often served as a parent figure herself.
My mom would have me put the kids to bed, and she'd have our house parties. They partied, they carried on. All the kids were with me. My siblings weren't really affected nor engaged in it. I seen a lot more than they did, and I think that's when I decided that I wanted to be different.
Despite her love for her family, Sonia told us that by the time she was a preteen, she had begun to feel the need to get out, to leave the instability of her family's current situation. She treasured the best things about her life with her mother, her mom's caring, giving nature, their large family, how they helped the community. But the chaos that came with the frequent parties and related activities had just become too much for Sonia. On top of that, she tells us that she and her mother simply had very similar personalities, and they'd often clash. That came to a boiling point during Sonia's early adolescence. When she was 11, she became a ward of the state and was placed in various group homes, but she told us that she was eventually moved to Washington in her mid-teens to a locked facility. Sonia told us that, in purposely acting out in a way that she calculated would have her removed from her parents' house, that she wasn't seeking out risky behavior. She was seeking stability in what seemed like the safest situation for her, specifically at the time. But the trade-off meant entering the system.
It was at that point that I was just finding any way to get out. And so if it was making me seem like I was a difficult child and one that couldn't be controlled or managed or corrigible with the adults, then that was my only option, because I didn't have a desire to commit any crimes or try to break any laws. I think in my own way, I was just looking for a way out. I left my siblings behind. They only took me from the home. They did not take the other six from the home. And I made sure that that's how that happened. I did not want her children to be taken from her. I was just wanting a way out. I stayed in a facility that I aged out of. They considered me, incorrigible. My runaways from the receiving homes that I was always placed in, those were leaving without permission. So the judge kicked me out of the courtroom and said only my attorneys could show up. And for me, because I asked him one day, well, with all due respect, Your Honor, am I supposed to go wake up the house parents and tell them, hey, can I have permission to leave? Then does that make it legal? But it changed me and it molded me. And so it wasn't by mistake, I don't think. I think I was the one of my mom's seven kids that broke the cycle, because the other ones live in the vicious cycle to this day. Thank God they, yeah, it really changed me and it made me a better person, I think.
When you did leave, when you were 15, did you keep in close touch with your siblings?
And my mom, and they would write me letters to the youth center. I would get letters, I'd write back, they'd send pictures, I'd send pictures. We stayed in contact, and I think it was my mother's prayers that saved me a lot of the time. You know, there was many times that she would write in her letters that she prayed I was okay, you know. She missed having me as part of the family, and I have many handwritten letters from her from when I was a very young age and living in that place, giving me the encouragement and the strength.
By the time Sonia was 18, she'd been out of the family home for 7 years, and her communication and relationship with her mother had improved. That was driven home when a special ceremony was held at the youth housing facility to mark her graduation from high school.
But my mother made it to Spokane for my graduation, and I had earned enough levels at the facility that I was in that I was able to go have dinner with her before going back. I got pictures on my wall in my living room because she took the time. Not everything was bad with us all the time. But yeah, I was actually just thinking, you know, it was sometime last week I was really struggling. For some reason, I woke up, my heart just felt heavy, and I was just really missing her. And I found myself staring. I have a shelf that's got like all of my lost loved ones, and found myself staring at her. When I struggle with my kids, I remember some of the conversations we have, and it helps me.
Sonia's mother and father had separated and reconciled a few times during her teenage years. And by the time Sonia was 18, her parents were both living separately in Montana with her younger siblings. When Sonia aged out of the system, she got to choose a one-way plane ticket to anywhere in the United States. She chose Spokane, Washington. After all, the state of Washington was one of her two homes, and she was close enough to be able to visit her family in Montana. But in Washington, she was able to begin her adult life on her own terms. After a short time spent living with some relatives, Sonia established her own home and began the business of adulthood. And then came a surprise. She was pregnant with her first child, her daughter. That connection created a new way for her to bond with her own mother. When Cherokee arrived for the baby's birth and Sonia went into labor, Cherokee took control, which in Sonia's mind was a very good thing since a lot of her relatives had showed up at the hospital. They were very excited for the baby's birth.
She was not the first grandbaby, but she was my first child. She showed up, bless her God, she was such a powerhouse. Always wanted to be in control. Come on, my girl, get up out of that bed. We're going to walk all the way back to you and back. My mother insisted one more time for me to take a walk. I collapsed. They brought me back upstairs. My daughter's head got stuck in the birth canal, covering her nose and mouth. So then everything started getting real intense at that time. And so my uncle kind of cleared the room. I had to go in for an emergency cesarean because I did 12, 13, 17 hours of dry labor. They screwed the screw on top of her head and gave her oxygen through that. And they did a emergency cesarean, only allowing one person in the room. And when I came back out to the delivery room, of course, everybody's still there. I want to see the baby. My mother was there for a little while longer. And then she left. She came back bright and early the next day with 3 big black construction bag full of little girl clothes. She went out to yard sales and just bought all this clothing. And of course, she stayed that day and helped me put most of the outfits on. As I got older, as I became an adult, and after becoming an adult, she was there for my daughter's birth. She was there for every monumental moment of my young adulthood.
Sonia's second child, her son, was born months early. That's when Cherokee decided that she'd move to Oregon, where Sonia had relocated, to help Sonia care for her baby and her small child. She was also caring for 2 of Sonia's nieces at the time, who came along.
She took care of him while I worked my 2 jobs. Like, I wasn't stressing at all. Like, she loved it. The only time she'd let me hold my son is when I was nursing, because that was the only time I needed to hold him. She embraced my children with love.
As much as Sonia appreciated her mother's help with her children, they had some friction. Sonia mostly chalks that up now, in hindsight, to their similar personalities. But her mother's short temper, with her, not the children, could become a sticking point. And eventually, they had what Sonia decided would be their last argument.
Mom, this is my house. I'm 27 years old. I run my home. We were just way too much alike. I wanted control of my house, but she wanted the control of my house.
Do you remember what you were arguing about? Was it something small?
I don't even. I think it was over what was going to be for dinner. I actually decided. She threw the glass plate and it became physical. I said, okay, that's it. I'm 27 years old. I can't be going through this in my own house and in front of my children. I wrote a check to Greyhound. I sent her and 2 of my nieces back to Montana.
So once she got back there, were you guys in touch? Did you talk to her?
No, I did not. That was the last time. I did not ever get the opportunity to tell her I was sorry. I never had an opportunity to make things right with her. At her funeral service, my godmother and I talked about this a lot. And she promised me that my mom knew that I loved her more than anything. But that is my biggest regret. And that's where I won't do with my own kids. I won't let them end the conversation with me on a bad note. We have to end on a good note, because I carry that regret in my heart probably for the rest of my days, that I was never able to say, hey, Mom, I'm sorry. I never had the chance to make it right with her. And hey, that's where a lot of my guilt was because I didn't know that those hateful words that she said to me before getting on that bus was going to be the last time I was going to hear her voice. And I tell my kids that every day. I don't want this to be our last words. We have to make it right before we part. Because you never promise the next given moment. Some people think I'm a little dramatic on that, but when you live through that yourself, and when you have that weighing on you every day, it really becomes very important not separate on a bad note. Because I would do anything in this world to have an opportunity to hug her and tell her I was sorry.
Cherokee Finley went missing in mid-April 1998. But Sonia didn't know that her mother had disappeared, not truly disappeared, until she received a phone call at work. It was the end of April, and she was at her second job, working as an armed security guard.
She said it was a call out of the blue. I never did like my daughter's father. And he had called and he said something about my mom. Sorry about your mom, but she was found dead. And I cussed him out, like literally used a bunch of profanity. How could you dare call me and say that? That is just so horrifying. And I called my uncles before finally my uncle answered. And he's like, oh, my girl, I'm so sorry to hear about your mom. And I just, reality had hit me.
When Cherokee was living with Sonia, she'd been sober. But when she returned to Montana, Sonia says her mother was using drugs and alcohol again. This background was known to local law enforcement, and Sonia and her family feel it was a factor in ruling Cherokee's death as accidental. Hypothermia with accompanying drug intoxication, a reason not to dig deeper, in the family's opinion. At the beginning of this episode, we told you about the things that Sonia knew and the things she didn't. She doesn't have all the details of her mother's day-to-day life after Cherokee left Oregon, but between her siblings, aunts, uncles, and family friends, she's gathered plenty of information after the fact. And there are a few facts that she's sure of. One, her mother was known to go on short trips without notifying anyone, which is why she wasn't immediately viewed as endangered missing by her relatives when she was gone for a night or two. Two, her mother always had a bag packed and ready to go for those trips, what she called her runaway bag. It was usually a large duffel bag or book bag. That bag had not been found with her body, though her purse was. Three, Cherokee had bought a car shortly before her death. Her family didn't even know about it. An elderly woman had come forward when the news of Cherokee's death ran in the paper and on the local news, and she'd reported the sale. And as far as Sonia knows, that car was never located. Four, and of most concern to Cherokee's loved ones, is perhaps best phrased as a question. If her death was accidental, why did so many rumors swirl of murder and of people in the Lake County area taking credit for her death? Next time on The Fall Line, we dig deeper into Cherokee Finley's death and the questions that still remain for her family. If you have any information regarding the death of Lily Cherokee Finley that would aid in or prompt a reopening or second look at her closed case, you can contact Missing Murdered Native Americans at gmail.com. That's Missing Murdered Native Americans at gmail.com. Sonia is currently planning a headstone ceremony for her mother, Cherokee Finley, and is raising money for that headstone. The headstone setting ceremony will be held on May 5th, 2023 in Montana. You can find a link to contribute in our show notes. If you know of a case that should be covered on The Fall Line, there's a link to the case submission form in the show notes as well. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIAs, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Millbrook Twins billboard and to fund therapy for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which patrons can enjoy starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kim Fritz, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrow. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the services of PIs.